This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. So we've all heard the story. Dave Chappelle had a bad night in Hartford. He got heckled. He walked off stage. He later called his audience evil, an arena full of suburban torturers and young white alcoholics as he joked about North Korea dropping a bomb on the capital city. Now, we may be a laugh line for Chappelle, but does Hartford deserve the bad press? The label is a place filled with racists? A lot of the national media seem to miss the fact that it's a poor city, 76% black and Hispanic, a place that struggles with a high achievement gap and extreme income inequality. But was Dave Chappelle onto something that night? Did he get us talking about an issue that is hidden in our state? Today, Where We Live, conversation about race and racism in Connecticut and New England, and we want you to join the conversation. What do you think about racism in our state? What has been your experience? 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive@wnpr.org, or you can tweet us at Where We Live. I want to welcome in our panelists first. Tiffany Jones is a blogger and a writer. She blogs at coffeerhetoric.com. She grew up in the north end of Hartford. And Tiffany, welcome to our show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Leah Wright is also here. She's an assistant professor of African American Studies and History at Wesleyan University. She's been on our program before, and it's good to have you back, Leah. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us from our New Haven studio is Bill Dyson. He's co-chair of the Connecticut Racial Profiling Prohibition Project Advisory Board at CCSU, Central Connecticut State University. He served in the Connecticut House of Representatives for 32 years, and he's worked in the New Haven school system for many years as well. William Dyson, welcome back to our program. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for the invite, for being here.
So what I want to do is start this conversation with a little bit of tape that we gathered as Katie Tolarski, the senior producer for Where We Live, was doing a story about the Chappelle concert that went so very, very badly for NPR. She'd written a big piece, or Anne-Marie Adams, who she interviewed, had done a big piece for Ebony. She's the editor of the Hartford Guardian, and she alluded to a bigger problem in the region, that racism exists and we don't want to talk about it. Let's listen to a bit of Anne-Marie Adams talking to Katie Tolarski.
It's not hard to talk about it in New York. It's hard to talk about it in Connecticut. And frankly, I've been researching that for more than 10 years. Why this historical amnesia in Connecticut? Why the reticence on talking about race? And it has to do with the cultural makeup, the New England ethos, I believe, and not addressing issues in public. There was a report that recently came out that Connecticut received an F for talking about the civil rights movement, and Mississippi and Alabama received like B's and A's. And I'm thinking because of their experiences and they had to talk about it, you see a much better relationship there and people are freely talking about race. Here in Connecticut, I think first you have to admit that you have a problem before you can talk about it. You will not talk about it if you don't think there is a problem.
And again, that's Anne-Marie Adams from the Hartford Guardian, and she'd written a piece about this after Dave Chappelle's performance here for Ebony magazine. And so I want to get some reaction to what she had to say first from our panelists. Tiffany Jones, does this strike you as right, that this is something that is happening all the time here in Connecticut and in Hartford, and something we just don't talk about?
I definitely think Anne-Marie is onto something. There's definitely this, for lack of a better term, this colorblind post-racial ideology here in Connecticut where people would rather espouse the progressive liberal front, you know, instead of in my experience, to even discuss racism is in and of itself racist. People would just rather gloss over it, not acknowledge it. It's kind of like out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah, when you say post-racial, and I used that term in the billboard of the program too, that's something we've heard an awful lot since the election of President Barack Obama. People say, well, if you got a black president, we are in a post-racial era. It doesn't matter anymore if a black man can be president. But go into that a little bit deeper when you talk about what post-racial might mean to people.
Well, when I say post-racial, I'm always meaning it in the snarkiest of ways. just this, yes, we have a black president, but even still, you look at the things Barack Obama has to go through with having to prove his citizenship, with being called a terrorist, the things that have been said about his wife. Post-racial, the term post-racial and even colorblind in and of itself to me anyway, and just from my research, is racist. Because when you're colorblind and you decide to believe that there's this post-racial society and that there's no more racism, that's racist. That's you refusing to acknowledge other people's humanity, and that's you refusing to tackle the issues and to not acknowledge that they exist. You're choosing to drown out people's lived experiences. So whenever I hear the term post-racial, I kind of cringe because it's a myth. Frankly, it's a myth. So I do think that there's this undercurrent of post-racial, colorblind, out of sight, out of mind kind of attitudes that pervade Connecticut, and particularly when it comes to Hartford.
When it comes to Hartford specifically. Leah, why don't you chime in? Give me some reaction to what Anne-Marie Adams had to say and your thoughts on this.
So I think Anne-Marie was right on the money, definitely right. But I think what I would argue is that Connecticut, more broadly, represents a paradox. We are one of the bluest states in the country. We are extremely progressive on a number of fronts. But on the other hand, we really have a problem when it comes to talking about race and dealing with race. I think part of this, and I'm sure we'll get into this more in the later discussion, has to do with the way in which Connecticut is set up. Hartford is one of, as you mentioned, one of the poorest cities in the states, but it's also surrounded by extreme wealth. It's also highly segregated. So the city is predominantly Black and Latino, whereas it's surrounded by suburbs that are predominantly white. And I think this creates very interesting dynamics and also has a very interesting and important history. And all of that really played out in the Dave Chappelle incident and how the media and the press have been talking about the Dave Chappelle incident.
Bill Dyson, I'd like to get your take on what Anne-Marie Adams had to say to start the show and this overall concept about this hidden racism that she and others see in Connecticut.
Well, I don't think it's all that hidden. I feel that the issue is talked about. It just may not be talked about in the context we'd like to talk about it. One doesn't have to go far to understand when you mention Hartford, you're talking about a group of people who reside in Hartford. So I think the issue is being talked about, but there may not be discussions taking place in organized fashion where there's a subject at hand would be, let's talk about what it is that we have not talked about openly and with each other and to share what it is that we think about what has taken place. So I think that's essentially my view on it. I'll expound some more later.
Well, I want to get to some phone calls, and people can join us at 860-275-7266. We've got a few calls, actually, both coming from Hamden. Hashim is calling from Hamden. Good to hear from you, Hashim. You're on Where We Live.
Yes, hi. Man, I just love your programming. You're always coming with issues that make so much impact here in the state. And I find this ironic because yesterday I just filed the paperwork to relocate my company to Brooklyn, New York. And really it's based on this fact and what you're talking about. I've gone through several of your on-location things, and I've mentioned a person of color in this state, doing the work I do, which is in the intellectual property arena, working with education and youth service programs. I'm looked at, and it's not even a double. It's a battle, which it just seems to be a uphill battle. We do good work. It's proven good work. We have the references for the good work. But, you know, just being a person of color and being the head of a company, people it's brutal here in Connecticut, and I chose to move the company. But I wanted to speak about when I first came to the state about 3 years ago.
Yeah.
I had a conversation with a gentleman, Al Martyr, who started the Amistad project here, the Freedom Trails. And Mr. Martyr made a statement that was really powerful and impacted me. He made a statement that says, you know, Hashim, if you think about the demographics and the census of Connecticut, everybody thinks there's a high percentage of people of color in this state. But the reality is, by consensus report, it's only 11%, and they're concentrated in areas. And if you think about the Amistad incident. You know, Connecticut, the reason why the Amistad was towed to Connecticut waters is because Connecticut embraced racism. They profited from the gains of racism and its policies. And I don't think that has ever changed in this state. They do things like, you know, glorify Amistad. And yes, we have the Amistad vessel here, but where's the support for getting in and getting really to the meat and having open dialogue? It's wonderful that you have it on your radio program, but when does this kind of conversation get into the boardrooms? When does this kind of conversation get into the state capitol? When does this kind of conversation get into our schools? Because Connecticut high schools are suffering from racist curriculum, the way things have put forward.
And Hashim, what I want to do, first of all, I want to thank you for your phone call. And in many ways, I'm sorry to hear that you're picking up and moving to Brooklyn, because we hear about people all the time moving their businesses out of state, sometimes down south. You're moving to New York City. I wish you best of luck in your new endeavors. And I want to get a little perspective from Leah Wright on some of this history that Hashim's talking about. Maybe you can just give us a little bit a deeper historical perspective on this story, so that we don't feel like we're just talking about the Hartford and Connecticut of right now, but we actually have some idea of how we got here.
Okay. Thank you, John, and thank you to the caller. Those were great comments and great questions. And I agree with some of what the caller said, right, which is that we really have this contested history. And I mentioned this before, but we have some very progressive things, right? So Hartford has been known kind of as, at different points, as the cradle of abolition, right? New England in general, the cradle of abolition. I think Anne Marie mentioned in her article for Ebony that Connecticut was one of the places where young Martin Luther King came and was received and was warmly welcomed in the early stages of the civil rights movement. At the same time, this is a place in the late 1960s and early 1970s that had a series of race riots, some of the worst in the country. We also have a particular and somewhat nasty history of white flight from urban areas. So these areas, and Tiffany mentioned before we started the show that she went to Weaver High School. Weaver High School, if you look at the class of 1950, is completely white. If you look at the class of 2000, the reverse is true. It's predominantly black. And part of this has to do with people moving out of the cities, not just for, say, economic opportunities or to get to the suburbs and have a suburban way of living, but also because things start to change when you live near neighbors of color. And it's much more complex than that. But there's definitely something there to it.
And Tiffany, maybe you can pick up on that a little bit to talk about how that influenced you believe the life that you had growing up in a North End that changed so much over time and became essentially a segregated neighborhood of mostly African American people.
excuse me. Like in my experience, you know, now that I look back on it, I had a pretty standard coming of age, but it was pretty segregated. I went to predominantly black and Latino schools. I went to a predominantly black high school, middle school, elementary school. So it was segregated. And then as I got older and as I came of age and as I became a teenager, I found myself almost having to defend being from Hartford, because I think what Hartford, even the term Hartford, becomes almost like a synonym. It becomes synonymous with almost saying, this will be a little controversial, the
sure.
N-word, or saying those people. And I hear when people refer to Hartford, it's almost like with this disdainful.
Well look, and you're not. I moved here almost 20 years ago to Connecticut from Boston. I grew up in Pittsburgh. And that term you just used, those people,
mm-hmm.
that's something I heard over and over again. The idea that a different group of people lived in the city
mm-hmm.
as opposed to around the city. And maybe that's what we're talking about when we're talking about this thing that's an undercurrent, and I want to get Bill Dyson back on this, because you're saying maybe it's something that we do talk about, Bill Dyson, but I think that, you know, in studio here, one of the conversations we seem to be having is that's the undercurrent we mean. It's that people use terms like those people in the city as a way of saying, essentially, they're going to live there, we're going to live here, mm-hmm. we don't have to go to school together, we don't have to necessarily work together, and it's this implicit, you know, de facto racism that we don't have to talk about all the time. It just is. What do you think, Bill?
I agree with all of that. Let me give an example. I am probably older than most people on this panel, so I come from an upbringing that is kind of covered the entire area. I lived in segregated South Georgia. I went to a segregated school. I thought I had a pretty good school life, my friends and all. I thought I learned a great deal, and I thought I became fairly sophisticated enough to operate in any environment, black or white. But nevertheless, the issue of racism still exists. It's here. We have a culture that consists of racism. You know, now, the difficulty may be we don't talk about it in a positive sense, a way in which we can sit over a cup of coffee or tea and just engage in having a dialogue with someone of opposite race and really share. I do that sometimes with people that I work with now, and they're in the studio here, is that I'll just share, talk openly, freely, and it allows them to talk openly and freely about what racism has been and what their experiences have been. My view is not enough of that takes place. And because it does not, then we have these situations like we talk about with David Chappelle.
We're talking with a panel about race and racism in Hartford and across our state, and we're going to get some more phone calls in just a moment. We've got a lot of emails as well coming in, where we live at WNPR.org. We want to hear once again from Anne Marie Adams as we're talking about the segregation that has happened through white flight. When she talked with Katie Tolarski for the story that Katie was doing for NPR about the Dave Chappelle incident, she was talking about the North End neighborhood where she grew up. Let's listen.
I grew up in that neighborhood, and being in that neighborhood, you are segregated from the rest of the city. When I was there, I felt like there was a lid pushing me down. At that time, I didn't know that's what was called racism, but in retrospect, it was being oppressed. You are oppressed. You can't go anywhere. You don't have the transportation or the wherewithal to travel outside of those blocks.
And Leah, so it goes beyond just a white flight that happens and this de facto segregation we're talking about. A neighborhood like the North End of Hartford, and happened in Bill Dyson's town down in New Haven as well, with urban renewal in the 1960s and 1970s. Highways come through and cut off a region. It's not lost on the people of the North End of Hartford that there's a highway cutting off one part of town, there's a highway cutting off the other part of town, big empty parking lots separating it from the downtown, a garbage dump on one other side of it. It feels to Anne Marie Adams, and I'm sure to a lot of other people, as though indeed a lid is being pressed down, something you can't escape.
I should also mention that I also grew up in the North End of Hartford as well, so it seems like we have a little North End contingency.
Yeah.
But I think everything that you and Anne Marie just mentioned, John, came to a head with the Sheff versus O'Neill case. These are a lot of the things that centered around parents who decided that they weren't going to be kind of, they weren't going to accept the lid being pressed down on them, who decided that they weren't going to accept unequal school systems, separate and unequal school systems. And so I think you really do see the after effects of white flight. It's also not as easy as telling residents, because there have been conversations around this, well, if you don't like it, get up and move. Because a lot of residents don't have the ability to move. So it's really not that simple. I think it's much more complex.
And a big part of the story of that white flight and regions in and around Hartford was some stories, very well-sourced stories about people trying to move and trying to go to other communities, essentially being steered by realtors to other neighborhoods that, that were more appropriate, quote unquote, for them. There's a lot of people who want to join us. Let's go to Valentina, who's calling from Bloomfield. Hi, Valentina. You're on Where We Live. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Valentina. I'm from Bloomfield, and I'm currently a student at Trinity. I read an amazing book by Kristen J. Anderson called Benign Bigotry that discusses not just racism, but sexism, homophobia, all of those things in the context of how they occur modern and, excuse me, contemporarily, which is that they are undertones, and it's not overt, it's not obvious, it's more so the things that are psychologically, sociologically, culturally, and institutionally just part of who we are as a society, and that they're things that take a certain level of awareness and a certain level of experience to even recognize. And I'm a black person. I'm from the Caribbean. But I grew up in Connecticut, grew up in the suburbs, went to D.C. for college. And it was when I came back after experiencing the diversity in D.C., experiencing an urban environment also, that I noticed certain things in Connecticut. You know, when I would sit down in a restaurant and me and my sister would be the only black people in the restaurant, you know, growing up in Connecticut, that was normal. Going to private schools, that was normal. But after being in D.C. and looking around, and not only the only black people, the only people of any kind of color in the restaurant, you know, it was then that I started to notice things like that, and which is not to say that, oh, well, that's because people are racist, but no, that's because things are structured a certain way in our communities and in our neighborhoods, and that structure definitely separates people. And as a black person as well who's moved back to Connecticut, you know, I, having experienced an urban environment, am no longer, like, afraid of the city of Hartford. which, you know, in Connecticut, yes, you say Hartford and it has certain connotations. And to the extent that I would sort of like my kids to have exposure to an urban environment at an earlier age than I am, so they're aware of certain things, or excuse me, than I was, so that they are aware of certain things. And in discussing that with, like, my family and friends, it was kind of like, well, you know, Hartford's scary. And if you live in Hartford, people are going to think a certain thing of you. And you're going to have trouble advancing in your career. And you're not going to get into the, you know, the medical school you want to get into, and et cetera. And granted, of course, all of that is.
Well, yeah, that's right. It's the things that aren't true, but yet somehow or other maintain in people's minds. Valentina, thank you so much for your thoughts. We got a tweet from Katie Z who says, there is a veiled undercurrent. People don't talk about it, but it's there. Being mixed race, she writes, I've heard countless remarks. We also heard from Neil, economic segregation. Reurbanization is a huge part of the answer. White flight was the impetus to the structural problems. Josh tweets us, because we're a mostly suburban state with small cities, it's easy for us to self-segregate and live separate lives. And one more email from Alyssa here, and she talks about something that we just talked about on our program. I clearly heard it on your program, Hidden Racism, that is, with UConn President Susan Herbst. She said numerous times that building in Hartford in the area where the city wanted to redevelop was too risky from a development, economic, and safety standpoint. Wrong, Alyssa writes. That is code for too poor and too black or Hispanic, when that is exactly who a public university needs to serve. I don't know, Tiffany, if you heard that conversation we had with Susan Herbst, but we came back to that. There's this dispute between UConn and the city over where to build. And a lot of people say the city should build in a place where there's nothing right now, big empty parking lots that maybe would help to bridge and get the north end a little closer to downtown. And essentially the president of the university said, that's too risky for us. We don't want to build there. What does that say to you?
What that says to me is that people enjoy being willfully ignorant and they willfully self-segregate. We talk about, and we were talking about the undercurrent, I believe the term for that, well, the new wave term is the daily microaggressions, where, you know, where the racism, it's not as overt. So when it's not overt, we don't acknowledge that it exists. But when you talk about issues like UConn not wanting to build in Hartford, that's one of the primary examples of what a microaggression is. And it's one of the primary examples of how the ways in which Connecticut is very racist.
Bill Dyson, quickly before our break, I'd like you to weigh in on this. You know, this is what Susan Herbst said. She called it the frontier. She didn't want to be part of a frontier development in Hartford. She wanted to do something that was safe for everyone, someplace that was going to be economically safe and also safe for the students. What does that say to you? I mean, should the state university, do you think, be engaged in building in a way that helps the people of all the city of Hartford, not just, you know, people who want to drive into a nice, almost suburban-like shopping center in the middle of town?
I think I can understand what the president of UConn is trying to say. Mm-hmm. You want a safe environment for all the students, regardless to who they are. And so any parent sending a child anywhere want that child to be safe. So president ought to be concerned about that. So so in that sense, I don't necessarily put it in the context of it being a racial issue. It's an issue of a good education for any student coming, public funding, which means that all students are entitled to it and have access to it. So I take another slant on that. And in addition to that, one slant that has not been talked about that and people very often overlook, it is going to be costlier for the institution to be built in an urban setting because the real estate is going to be more expensive. You can get more building if you have it in a place where you're not competing for the land that's available, that's limited. So it becomes an issue by which you constrict the amount of space that you'll be able to get out of it, and as a result, neglect to expand or provide the broad-based education that you can provide. So I think it's appropriate for the president to be concerned about those things, and I think maybe probably need to explain it a bit more so that people fully understand it's not intended to be racist, see, and that she does not have racial designs on this. But you have design by which you're going to provide education for all students and that they're going to be safe. And all parents whose kids are going to be there can feel comfortable knowing that their kids are in a safe environment and one which is going to provide them with an education.
We
have to understand as well,
yeah,
this is a tax issue. It's a tax issue in terms of payment for, and do we go to a place where the land is more expensive or expensive to build a building, or to another place.
I got to break in because we do have to take a break, and there's a lot of people who want to join the conversation on the phone. William Dyson has been involved in education for years. He's now at CCSU, and we're going to be talking about the Connecticut Racial Profiling Prohibition Project coming up with him in just a moment. Leah Wright is here from Wesleyan University. She's an assistant professor of African American Studies and History. Tiffany Jones is a writer and a blogger at CoffeeRhetoric.com. We're having a post-Dave Chappelle conversation about race and racism in Hartford and Connecticut. And we would love to hear from you at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about racism in Connecticut, prompted by some bad press the city of Hartford got after comedian Dave Chappelle essentially walked off stage to a heckling crowd. In later shows, he was sure to make the point that the crowd was suburban and white. It got a lot of people talking about whether or not there's a problem with racism in Connecticut and Hartford that we just don't talk about. So here in Where We Live, we like a challenge. We want to talk about it, and that's what we're doing at 860-275-7266. Our guests are Tiffany Jones, Leah Wright, and William Dyson, and he joins us from our New Haven studios. I want to get to some phone calls here. Karen is calling, and I believe, Karen, you're at the Connecticut Fair Housing Center? Go ahead.
Aaron, yes.
Aaron, I apologize. Hi. Good to talk to you, Aaron.
Good to talk to you, yes. Aaron Boggs of the Connecticut Fair Housing Center. Yeah, I just wanted to mention a couple things. Obviously, we work on this issue every day. I want to correct a little data that was mentioned earlier. Connecticut is actually 29% people of color, and it's an incredibly fast-growing population. So when we think about what we're doing in the future and what Connecticut looks like in the future, we are a really diverse state, but we are highly segregated. We really are one of the most segregated states in the entire country. And we got to look at why that's going on, and I think there are at least you know, lots of reasons, but one is housing discrimination. We're finding rates of discrimination at about 62% in rental housing when we send out our fair housing testers. We have to look really hard at where we're placing our subsidized housing, which is disproportionately needed by people of color because they are lower income. And we have to look hard at our zoning. That's a huge, huge barrier to where we can put affordable housing. And then the last thing I just wanted to say is, you know, the more we're separated, the more we're going to build up stereotypes about each other, and things that we've been talking about this morning are going to happen. But we need to think about the people of color in Connecticut as our economic future. That is the population that's growing. And we also need to think about, there are lots of white people in Connecticut who recognize this as a problem, recognize that for their kids to be able to be competitive in diverse workplaces in the future, they need to have experience with diversity as they're growing up.
Yeah, and I think it's also important from a jobs perspective, too, to make sure that our caller that we heard from before, Hashim, and people like him who are trying to start businesses here in Connecticut, have a place to start those businesses here in Connecticut and don't have to move to Brooklyn or North Carolina or California. Aaron, thanks so much. Always good to hear from you. John's in Kensington. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Hi, what's up?
I wanted to say that first let me preface my comments by saying I'm white. And I think there's racism everywhere. I think it's absolutely everywhere. I completely agree with all the speakers before me. But I think that the war on racism is really the war on poverty. And I think that we've attacked the war on poverty the way we've attacked the war on terrorism. And we spent a lot of money, and we don't seem to have made any progress. Somebody with a $25 roadside bomb can knock our empire over after we've spent billions. And I think the war on poverty is the same. I think that the poverty pimps have taken all of the money, and the poor people are left holding the bag. We see it in the front page of the Hartford Current.
John, I want to break in. I think, no, you raise a really interesting point that I want to get to with our panel. I'm sitting across from Tiffany, and you're shaking your head. And this is one of the things that we talk about on the show an awful lot. If we talk about racism and we immediately turn to poverty, then, look, I think we have to solve a problem of poverty in the state. And I think it's realistic to say that an awful lot of the people who are poor in the state are people of color. That said, do you align the two? Is racism and poverty, are they, you know, always joined at the hip?
Yes, they are. And I feel like when you take that out of the equation and you just make it a blanket issue, like it's not a war on race, it's a war on poverty, you're decontextualizing the problem in the conversation. And as far as I'm concerned, that makes it even more difficult to try to tackle. So, I mean, I understand what the caller is saying, but decontextualizing the issue and making it an issue that doesn't have these different intersections, it doesn't solve the problem or acknowledge it.
And it also, I think in some ways it skips over this fact, Leah, that I think many people in Connecticut see every day, which is you can be not poor, you can be financially successful, and every single day you can experience some sort of racism in your everyday life.
Right. And I don't mean to discount something like economic civil rights, because that's really been at the next stage, I'd argue, of the civil rights movement. And it's something that we can't ignore, we can't forget. But I think saying that race and class are the same thing completely neglects the fact that wealthy black people, wealthy Latino people also have the same problems. They're racially profiled, right? So the idea that you have green in your pocket doesn't stop you from getting pulled over for driving a really fancy car. And that's just one example, but it's this kind of idea that there is something about your race that renders treatment different and problematic that I think we need to explore.
And in our next segment, we're going to be talking about the Connecticut Racial Profiling Prohibition Project at CCSU, and talking more about this problem that is happening in many, many, especially suburban communities. But let's go to Alex in New Haven quickly. Hi, Alex.
Yeah, you touched upon, I just wanted to say hello to Bill and John. Thanks for having Bill on today, John. I wanted to say, and the guest talked about it just a second ago, but how much class and the values that come, or the values that you have, influence racism. I find that myself, that if someone holds my values, not necessarily even in the same class, but they hold my values, that no matter what color they are, I feel more comfortable with them, and the opposite is true. So I'd love to hear your comments about that.
Thank you very much, Alex. Holding your values, I guess I'm wondering what he means by that. I want to get to another quick phone call here that might get us a little closer to what you're asking here, Alex. Carol's in Milford. Hi, Carol.
Hi, John. Love your show. Huge fan. I'm a white woman. I live in Connecticut. I've been here for 13 years. But I grew up in poverty in Baltimore City, and I work at Yale University. And a lot of times when I share my experience about growing up in poverty, I experience a lot of prejudice against, you know, those people who grow up in poverty. And I try to talk to my white friends about how the fact that they're really being racist because you can't, like the panel member just said, you know, race and class are two different things. And that I think that a lot of Caucasian white people sort of hide their racism against by, you know, pretending that it's prejudice against poverty. And it's hard to get them to see the difference between those two things. Thank you.
Thank you very much. In some ways, I think our last two callers are circling around the same kind of issue here, Tiffany. What do you think?
Now, firstly, I just want to say that I definitely agree with you in terms of race and class. But the point I was trying to make and to expound on what the caller said, you can be, there are wealthy people of color who are also oppressed and marginalized. But even when white people say, well, I grew up poor, you still have privilege over a person of color that's in poverty. So it's essential to recognize those intersections, even when you're talking about race in terms of class or growing up poor. You know, poverty is an issue, but there's still those different intersections within poverty. I don't know if I'm making sense, but she's still, when you're a white person and you grew up in poverty, you still have some privilege over like a black or Latino person who's also growing up in poverty.
Right. Just to jump on what Tiffany was saying, there have been a number of studies in the past couple of years that have shown that if you take two people from, you know, from equal economic upbringings, say both low income economic upbringings, one is white, one is black, the one who is white will have significant advantages in getting jobs. In fact, they'll have advantages in getting jobs over someone who is black with a college degree. And I think that's part of what Tiffany is trying to parse out here, right? That there are implicit things that are tied up in whiteness, in blackness, and being Latino that create kind of inequalities, privilege, and things like that.
Bill Dyson, do you agree with what you're hearing right now?
Yeah, I agree with it. And I'd like to add to it.
Please.
What I'd like to add is that racism comes out of ignorance. You know, and it's ignorance in which people do not understand statements that were just previously made. Even though two people can be poor, but one will have an advantage over the other. Yes, that stuff exists. But the dominant theme for me is it comes out of ignorance, that this stuff is fostered. And racism is here. It's here and is here because of the ignorance. And so what we have to engage in doing is what is we do to begin to combat the racism. Now we're back to what we started with, and that is having a dialogue, talking about it, addressing it, not pretending that it's not there, engaging and connecting with others to talk about what this thing is. Other than that, it's going to be with us. We had the 50th annual celebration of the March on Washington the other day. The next 50 years, we may have another panel having the same discussion about the same issue.
Well,
50 years from now.
I certainly hope that we have a lot of conversations about this here on Where We Live, and we don't have to wait 50 years to solve the problem. We're talking with some panelists who've thought a lot about this issue, Bill Dyson, who we're going to be talking a bit more about racial profiling in Connecticut with in a moment. He joins us from our New Haven studios. Leah Wright is here. She's from Wesleyan University. Tiffany Jones is a blogger, and she joins us in studio as well. We're going to come back and take some more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. Email's wherewelive@wnpr.org. You can tweet us at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, just last month, the Tennessee judge ruled that the parents of a baby boy that they named Messiah must change his name to Martin. While some of us may cringe at this unusual name, did you know Messiah was actually the fourth fastest growing baby name in 2012? Yes, indeed. So coming up, we'll talk about names, how they play a role in personal identity, how they influence who we become. That's coming up on the next Where We Live. Today, we're talking about race and racism in Hartford and New England, something we don't talk an awful lot about. We try to talk about here on the show. Dave Chappelle, when he talked about Hartford on stage and then again in concerts afterward, got us thinking a lot about racism in Hartford. So we're talking about it now. 860-275-7266. Bill Dyson joins us. He, of course, served in the House of Representatives in the state for 32 years, been working in education in the New Haven area for some years. And Bill Dyson, now you're working at CCSU on the Connecticut Racial Profiling Prohibition Project. I think you have some folks with you, Andrew Clark and Ken Barone. I'm wondering if you guys can just lay out quickly what this project is all about. What it is you're trying to do?
Well, what we're trying to do is respond to part of what we've been talking about this morning, and that's the issue of racism. What we had happen is that, I'm not singling East Haven out, but we did have an issue that manifested itself in East Haven that clearly we needed to do something. And so what happened is that the governor put together a group of people to take a look at this issue and provide some recommendations to what we should do about this issue. And so we've been working at it now for about 2 years to try to come up with a plan of action that we would engage in collecting the information, trying to determine who is it that's engaging in the profiling, and then to come forth with some remedies to deal with it. So Andrew can tell you more about the details of it, and as well as Ken. So I'll turn it over to Andrew at this point.
Sure. Essentially, in 1999, a law was passed, the Alvin Penn Act, it became known as, resulting from former Senator Alvin Penn in a feeling that he was profiled in a traffic situation in this town of Trumbull in Connecticut. The legislature passed the law. There was a report that came out shortly thereafter, but since that time, up until about 2010, nothing had really been done to fully implement the collecting and analyzing of data with regard to traffic stops in Connecticut. And so when Governor Malloy came on, he became aware of funds that were available through the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to be able to implement a racial profiling law in your state. And so our institute went after those funds with the assistance of the State Department of Transportation, and now we've been administering them for the better part of 2 years with the aim of fully implementing the Alvin Penn Act and being able to determine if profiling exists. But also there's broad factors of funding that we are looking to implement as well, and that's...
Well, and I just want to jump in quickly because we're running low on time. We want to get to a lot of phone callers who want to join the conversation about some of these issues. Ken, I know one of the things that happened since this law was passed was, you know, the state and the various communities were supposed to be collecting all this data on racial profiling stops coming from all of the various municipalities, and it just wasn't getting done. Some cities and towns weren't actually providing the information. The state wasn't able to do anything about it. How is this new program going to change anything?
I think this new program, Connecticut has really doubled down their effort to get law enforcement to collect data. And there's now a real effort on the part of the Office of Policy and Management to be capable of collecting and analyzing the data, where before, Connecticut wasn't in a position to really accept the data. We have to remember that Connecticut conducts about 600,000 traffic stops in a year, which becomes the most common police citizen encounter. And so storing and collecting information on 600,000 traffic stops can become a bit of a burden. And I think Connecticut's in a much better position today than they were 5-6 years ago to be able to handle that volume.
I want to get to some phone calls here, because obviously racial profiling by police is one of the many issues that comes up when we talk about this. But we do want to get to some more people who want to join us. Yah is calling from Cromwell. Hello there. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Okay. Mine is not about racial profiling, but I think you touched on lumping racism with poverty. I'm not considered by any means. I consider myself poor by the standards. I'm not poor. I live in the suburbs, and I do face racism. I see racism in my church. I live in Cromwell. My church is in Hartford. You will see white people sitting on one side and black people sitting on the other side. I have racism in my neighborhood, where there are neighbors who go from door to door to talk to the people that they consider acceptable, which is mostly the white people. But I have a story. Once I was living in Rocky Hill, and the junior women's group prospect me, and on my way to the library one time, and they started calling me, come to the meeting. I gave them excuses. I couldn't go. They eventually convinced me to just show up for one meeting. Well, based on my name, they didn't know I was black. The first time I walked in there, they started finding ways to get rid of me. They would come up with excuses of not finding my number. That's why they couldn't invite me to a gathering at a restaurant or something. And because they were doing that, I was also determined to stay in there because I found it so funny. But the pain and the duration that they went through to exclude me was just funny, and I persisted. Because of that, if I didn't have time, I would just go, just so that I would sit there, because they called me not knowing who I was. There's racism in Connecticut on a personal level, not just on the state level. I lived in New York for 10 years, and I have never felt isolated. I never felt isolated in New York as I feel in this state.
Well, I'm going to let you go, and thank you so much for your phone call. And I want to finish up our conversation with my guest in the studio here. And I think she gets us back to the point that we really started this conversation with. People do self-segregate. It's not just about their neighborhoods. It's not just about their schools. But it's about what table you sit at and, frankly, what concerts you go to. And the Dave Chappelle thing was interesting because he's headlining a show full of mostly white comedians for a mostly white audience. And there's a segregation at play there. I mean, I'll ask you first, Tiffany. Is part of what we're talking about just people getting up, as Bill Dyson said before, talking about it, seeking out people who don't look like them, and just having more conversations, making more friends? I mean, does that actually help the situation we're talking about here?
We do have to have a dialogue, and we have to talk about it, and we have to acknowledge the many layers of racism, and acknowledge that it's not just when people think of race, they think of Southern racism and the Ku Klux Klan. You have to deconstruct the daily microaggressions, and like the caller said, one way to be discriminatory towards a person of color is you can be racist via exclusion. We have to have a dialogue. We have to be honest. And I think one crucial thing is that white people have to have these dialogues with each other. If you see it, call out your peers and call one another out.
And that's actually saying, and Lee, I'll give you the last 20 seconds here.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
I was just going to say that yes, racism exists, but it's very different forms. It's not explicit racism. A lot of it is implicit racism. And having dialogues is a start, but also how you craft the language around those dialogues is really important.
I did appreciate this dialogue, and we'll have to continue it. Leah Wright and Tiffany Jones, William Dyson, thank you all very much for your time. Thanks to senior producer Katie Swalarski for putting together our panel today on Where We Live.